Okay, so let's dive into something that maybe sounds a little familiar, right? A rigged election. Except this one goes back to West Virginia, way back to 1970. And it ended up all the way in the Supreme Court. It's Anderson v. United States. And it's a case that's really surprisingly relevant to election law even today, even this far after 1970.
What's really kind of fascinating about Anderson is how it forces us to think about the line. You know, where do we draw the line between just like local, election shenanigans and actual federal crimes? And especially when we're talking about, elections, it really gets kind of murky.
And we've got some really interesting source material. We've got the original Supreme Court opinions on this case. We've got some analyses that connect it to present day concerns. So we're really trying to like bridge the gap between what happened back then and what's going on right now.
And that's key because Anderson isn't just some like dusty old, legal relic from the past. It raises questions that are still being debated today, about federal power, about voter rights, and about election integrity.
So paint the picture for us. Like what exactly happened in Logan County, West Virginia? What happened that like launched this whole case up to the highest court in the land?
So to picture this, it's the Democratic primary election, May 12th, 1970. Seems like a pretty, standard local affair, right? But here's the thing. The ballot includes races for U.S. Senate and House of Representatives alongside the county commissioner candidates.
Oh, so we've got those big names, the federal level elections, tangled up with just like a local power struggle. I'm guessing that's where things get kind of messy, right?
Exactly. The whole case revolves around this conspiracy to make sure that a specific candidate got the nomination for county commissioner, a guy named Okie Hager. But it wasn't just like your typical, mudslinging campaign. This is next level stuff. We're talking about, messing with the voting machines, destroying the poll slips so they couldn't, figure out the real turnout. They even cast fake votes.
Wow, fake votes back in 1970. I'm guessing it wasn't like as sophisticated as, the hacking scandals we hear about today, right?
No, you're right about that. Back then, a lot of the counting was still done, manually by hand. So it was a lot easier to slip in, fraudulent votes without raising too many eyebrows. They think that there were probably around 100 fake votes cast.
100 fake votes, that's a lot. You'd think someone would notice. So how did they even get caught?
It all unraveled because of, well, good old-fashioned perjury. Hager won the nomination, but it was super close, just 21 votes. His opponent, wasn't going to let that stand, so he filed an election contest, which led to a hearing.
Okay, so we've got a contested election, a hearing. Things are getting pretty intense. What happened next?
Two of the guys involved in the conspiracy, Earl Tomblin and John Browning, they tried to cover up what they had done by lying under oath during that hearing. And that perjury, that was the key. That's what exposed the whole conspiracy.
So their attempt to cover up the fraud is what brought the whole thing crashing down. That's
Right.
kind of ironic. But we're still talking about a local election here.
Yeah.
How in the world did this end up, all the way to the Supreme Court?
And that's where this idea of a single conspiracy
Yeah.
really comes into play. The guys who were petitioning the court, they were convicted under 18 U.S.C. Section 241, which is a federal law about conspiracies to deprive citizens of their civil rights.
Yeah.
And it's a law that has roots back in Reconstruction, originally aimed at protecting Black voters from intimidation and violence.
Wait, so a law that was meant to combat, racial discrimination in voting was used to prosecute a case of election fraud in 1970. How does that even connect?
That's what's so interesting about this case. You see, the Anderson case, it wasn't about like outright voter suppression based on race, but the court applied that law, Section 241, because the conspiracy, even though it was focused on a local race, it also involved casting those fake votes in federal races too.
So that connection to a federal election, even if it wasn't the main target, that's what brought it under federal jurisdiction. So even if they were mainly, trying to rig that county commissioner seat, messing with those federal votes, even as
Right.
part of that larger scheme,
Yeah.
that triggered the federal charges. That's a pretty big legal concept, right?
It is. It's this idea that you can't just compartmentalize your intentions. If any part of your plot touches a federal race, well, then it becomes a federal issue.
It's like saying you robbed a bank, so it doesn't matter that you also stole a candy bar from the store next door, right? It's all part of, that same criminal act. But I'm guessing the defense attorneys, they probably had something to say about this, right? They weren't just going to let the case, go federal without a fight.
Oh, of course not. They argued that that law, that 18 U.S.C. 241, should only apply to conspiracies that are specifically targeting, federal elections. They were basically saying, hey, we were just trying to rig this local race. The federal candidates, they were incidental. We weren't really focused on them.
So a bit of a we didn't mean to break that law kind of defense. Did that work?
Well, not really. The Supreme Court, they ultimately upheld their convictions, but they really focused on this concept of a single conspiracy with multiple objectives. So they didn't actually rule on whether that law covers conspiracies that are purely focused on state or local elections.
Okay. Now I'm intrigued. Break down what the court meant by a single conspiracy with multiple objectives. How did they justify upholding the convictions if they didn't specifically address the scope of that law in local elections?
Basically, the court said that you can have a single plot, right? Even with lots of different aims, and it can still violate federal law if any of those aims involve a federal offense. And since this conspiracy included casting those fake votes for the U.S. Senate and House candidates, well, that triggered federal jurisdiction.
So it didn't matter that their primary goal, their main focus, might have been rigging that local commissioner race. The fact that they also tampered with, federal votes, even as part of that same scheme, that was enough to bring the full weight of federal law, crashing down on them.
Exactly. And this is where the court brings in this concept of vruch dilution. Mm. They argued that any type of election fraud, no matter how small, no matter how seemingly insignificant, it undermines the whole electoral process.
Hold on, vote dilution. Yeah. That sounds important. Tell me more about what that means and why the court cared about it so much.
The court was essentially saying that every voter has this fundamental right to have their vote fairly counted without it being, distorted by fraudulent votes. They argued that election fraud, regardless of which candidate or office it targets, it injures all voters' constitutional rights because it dilutes the value of, those legitimate votes.
So it's not just about, the candidates who might have lost because of the fraud. It's about the integrity of the entire system.
Yeah.
And the rights of every voter.
Exactly. It's a powerful argument, and it raises some really interesting questions about the balance of power between states and the federal government when it comes to elections.
And speaking of interesting questions, wasn't there a dissenting opinion in this case? I'm guessing not everyone on the court, agreed with this broad interpretation of federal power.
You're right. Justice William O. Douglas, who was, known for his strong emphasis on states' rights, he wrote a dissenting opinion. That raises some serious concerns about how far federal law should reach into state-level elections.
Okay, now I'm really hooked. What did Justice Douglas argue? And why is his dissent worth paying attention to, especially today with so much debate about, federal involvement in elections?
Yeah, that's where we'll pick up in part two of our deep dive into Anderson v. United States. Welcome back to our deep dive into Anderson v. United States. Last time we kind of left off with a cliffhanger, talking about Justice Douglas's dissent.
Yeah, that whole vote dilution argument and the idea that a local election fraud scheme could trigger federal charges because it's, touched a federal race. It's fascinating, but I'm sure it sparked some pretty strong opinions, right? Especially back then with all the history of federal intervention in state affairs, especially in the South.
You're right. The historical context, it really matters here. Remember that law, that 18 U.S.C. Section 241, the one at the heart of this case, it was originally passed during Reconstruction, to protect the voting rights of newly freed Black citizens in the South. It was a response to all that widespread voter intimidation and violence that was aimed at disenfranchising Black voters.
So we've got this law with deep roots in the fight for racial equality.
Oh, right.
And it's being applied to a case of election fraud in West Virginia in 1970.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't about, stopping Black people from voting, but it was about manipulating the system to favor a particular candidate.
Yeah.
Did the court address that shift in context at all?
That's where Justice Douglas's dissent really comes in. He argued that that Congress, you know, they didn't intend for that law, for Section 241, to apply to like non-racial state level election fraud. He believed the majority opinion was stretching the law way too far.
Yeah.
And he was worried it was creating a slippery slope, you know, where the federal government could just insert itself into any local election dispute.
So it sounds like he was really worried about federal overreach.
Mm.
Did he think that states should have complete control over their elections, mm-hmm. even if there's, you know, fraud going on?
He was definitely concerned about maintaining a balance of power, you know,
yeah.
between the states and the federal government. He wasn't saying that states should be free to just ignore election fraud, right? His point was that unless there's clear evidence of racial discrimination or a direct intent to affect a federal election, these matters should be handled at the state level, not the federal level.
That makes sense. It goes back to that core principle of federalism, right? The,
yeah.
the idea that states have certain rights and powers that the federal government can't infringe upon. But how did Justice Douglas view the specific facts of this case? Did he think the conspirators' actions were justified, or was he just more concerned about the legal precedent being set?
He acknowledged that what the conspirators did was wrong, but he really took issue with how the majority opinion interpreted the specific intent requirement of that law, Section 241.
Right.
Remember, the law requires proof that the conspirators acted with the specific intent to deprive someone of their civil rights.
Right, right, yeah. And the majority opinion said that the intent to cast fraudulent votes, you know, regardless of the specific race or office, that was enough to meet that requirement because it harms the integrity of the whole system.
Yeah.
But Justice Douglas, he wasn't convinced.
Exactly. He argued that the jury instructions in the case, they were flawed because they didn't specifically require the jury to find that the petitioners intended to affect the federal elections.
Yeah.
He believed there should have been a clear distinction, you know, between the intent to rig the local commissioner race and any intent to influence the federal races.
So just because they rigged the election, it doesn't automatically mean that they intended to interfere with the federal races.
Yeah.
There has to be clear evidence of that specific intent to harm the right to vote in a federal election.
Yeah.
I'm starting to see why this dissent is so important, especially in today's world where election integrity is such a hot button issue.
Absolutely, Justice Douglas. He was essentially arguing for a higher bar, you know, for federal intervention in state level elections. He wanted to see clear proof of an intent to impact a federal race, not just evidence that fraud occurred in an election where federal candidates happened to be on the ballot.
It raises a really tricky question. How do we balance the need to protect the integrity of all elections, right, including the federal ones, with the principle of respecting state autonomy? It's a debate that's still going on today.
You're right, Anderson v. United States. It didn't settle these questions, but it certainly highlighted the complexities and the potential pitfalls, you know, mm-hmm. of applying federal law to local election disputes, and that's why this seemingly obscure case from 1970 it still resonates today. It forces us to think about those fundamental tensions between federal power and states' rights and how we safeguard the right to vote in a system where those powers are constantly being negotiated.
Okay, so we've got this fascinating historical and legal context, right? We've got a divided Supreme Court and a dissenting opinion that's still relevant to today's debates about elections.
Uh-huh.
But let's get back to those nuts and bolts of the legal arguments for a second.
Okay.
The transcript mentions something called the admissibility of statements. What was that all about?
This is where things get really interesting because it involves how prosecutors build a case, especially in a complex conspiracy. Remember how two of the conspirators, Tomlin and Browning, they lied under oath during that hearing after the election? Well, the defense argued that those statements made after the election results were certified, they shouldn't have been used against them in court.
Wait, well, why not? It seems like those lies, those would be, you know, pretty damning evidence.
Their argument was based on the idea that the conspiracy had already ended, you know, when the election results were certified. There's this legal principle called termination, which basically says that statements made by conspirators after a conspiracy has ended, they can't be used against other members of the conspiracy.
So it's like they were trying to say, hey, the election was over, the results were official. Anything we said after that point was just us talking, you know, that wasn't part of the conspiracy.
Yeah.
Did that argument fly?
The Supreme Court didn't buy it. They said that the perjury was admissible because it fell under a key exception to the termination doctrine, the cover-up exception.
Cover-up exception. Okay, I'm all ears. Explain that one. Yeah.
It essentially means that if conspirators continue to take actions to conceal their crime, you know, even after the main goal of the conspiracy has been achieved, those actions and any statements made during them can still be used as evidence against them. It's like trying to wipe away your fingerprints after you've already robbed the bank, right? It doesn't erase the crime.
So in this case, lying under oath to protect the outcome of the rigged election, that was seen as part of the ongoing conspiracy, right? To cover up their tracks.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't just loose talk after the fact. It was a deliberate attempt to hide their crime.
Exactly. The court reasoned that the perjured testimony wasn't being used to prove the truth of what they were saying, but rather to show their motive, which was to conceal the conspiracy. And that motive was directly tied to the original plan to rig the election.
That's a pretty clever legal strategy by the prosecution.
Yeah.
You know, they use the conspirators' own attempts to cover up their crime as evidence against them. But it also raises some questions, right? Like how far does that cover up exception extend? Could any statement made after a crime, even years later, be used against someone if it's seen as an attempt to conceal the original act?
Those are great questions, and they get to the heart of how evidence is used in criminal cases, especially when you're dealing with conspiracies. The line between a genuine attempt to conceal a crime and a statement that's unrelated to the original conspiracy, it can be pretty blurry.
It seems like there's a lot of room for interpretation there.
Mm.
And that could have implications for defendants' rights.
Mm.
This is reminding me of those crime dramas, you know, where they're always arguing about whether evidence was obtained legally and whether it's admissible in court.
You're hitting on a crucial point. Legal precedent matters. How courts interpret these doctrines, these rules of evidence, it shapes how future cases are handled. Anderson gives us a specific example of how the cover-up exception was applied, and that can guide how similar cases are handled in the future.
This deep dive is really revealing how much complexity there is, you know, beneath the surface of what might seem like a straightforward case of election fraud. We've got historical context, competing interpretations of federal law, a dissenting opinion that raises concerns about federal overreach, and now this deep dive into the rules of evidence and how they can impact a case.
And there's even more to unpack. In part three of our deep dive into Anderson v. United States, we'll explore the lasting legacy of this case, how it's shaped legal strategies, and how it resonates in our current political landscape where election integrity is constantly in the headlines.
Welcome back to the Deep Dive. We've been kind of unpacking this case, Anderson v. United States, a case that started with a rigged election in West Virginia way back in 1970. And it's really taken us on this journey through like the legal thickets and the historical context, even some courtroom drama, right?
Yeah, we've seen how this, you know, seemingly local conspiracy, you know, because it ended up involving a federal race. It ended up all the way in the Supreme Court, raising all these questions about federal power and states' rights and the right to vote.
We've talked about that single conspiracy doctrine, right? And the concept of vote dilution and that intriguing cover-up exception and Justice Douglas's dissent, which feels, you know, surprisingly relevant even today when we're talking about election integrity.
And that's exactly where we need to go now, right? Like, how does Anderson v. United States, a case from 1974, how does it still resonate in our current political climate?
It seems like every election cycle, you know, we get fresh allegations of fraud, new controversies about voting rules, this kind of tug of war between those who want more federal oversight and those who, you know, fear federal overreach. Does Anderson give us any insights into how we navigate these challenges today?
Absolutely. I think Anderson serves as a cautionary tale for both sides of that debate. Mm. You know, for those folks who are advocating for greater federal involvement in elections, the case highlights the potential reach of federal law and the argument that any fraud, even in a local race, you know, can undermine the integrity of the whole system.
So they could point to Anderson and say, look, even a local scheme, you know, can have national implications. We need federal oversight to make sure that elections are fair everywhere.
Exactly. They can argue that concept of vote dilution, right, as it was articulated in Anderson. It makes it clear that any fraudulent vote, regardless of which specific race it's, you know, targeting, it diminishes the value of those legitimate votes and it harms the entire electorate.
But what about the other side? You know, the folks who are wary of federal intervention and what they see as a state issue. Does Anderson offer any kind of support for their arguments?
It does. They can point to Justice Douglas's dissent, you know,
yeah.
which warned against an overly expansive interpretation of federal power when we're talking about elections.
Right.
They could argue that Anderson sets a dangerous precedent, you know, potentially allowing the federal government to insert itself into any local election dispute just under the guise of protecting federal interests.
So it becomes a question of where do we draw the line, right? How do we make sure that federal elections have integrity, but without stepping on states' rights to run their own elections?
That's exactly the tension that Anderson exposes, and it doesn't offer any easy answers, right?
Yeah.
But it does provide this framework for thinking about these complex issues. It reminds us that the right to vote is precious, and protecting it requires constant vigilance. This delicate balance between federal oversight and state autonomy.
It also highlights how legal precedent, you know, really matters. The way that courts interpret laws and apply doctrines like the single conspiracy doctrine or the cover-up exception, you know, it can have these really, really far-reaching consequences. It can shape how future cases are handled.
You're absolutely right, and that's why it's so crucial for lawyers, for law students, for anyone who's, you know, interested in the health of our democracy to understand cases like Anderson. They give us this glimpse into the machinery of our legal system and how it tries to grapple with these really fundamental questions about power and rights and the very foundation of our government.
So we've covered a lot of ground in this deep dive. We've explored the facts of the case, the legal arguments, the historical context, and even the implications for how we think about elections and federal power today. But if there's one thing that you want our listeners to take away from this whole discussion about Anderson, what would it be?
I think the key takeaway is this: Anderson v. United States. It's a reminder that the right to vote, It's not the static thing, you know. Mm-hmm. It's not this guaranteed right. It's a right that people fought for, and it continues to be challenged and debated and reinterpreted. Understanding cases like Anderson, it helps us understand the complexity of those debates, the nuances of the law, and the importance of really engaging in thoughtful, informed conversations about how we protect and strengthen our democracy.
It's a case about a rigged election in a small town, but it's also a case about the soul of our nation, the principles that we hold dear and the challenges that we face in making sure those principles are upheld.
And that's a conversation that's worth continuing, both in the courtroom and in the public square.